The words in Hebrew, well, anyway, Daniel was promised, as you know, great wealth and power if he would interpret the words. The irony of that is what? Yeah, after that night, there'd be nothing there to give. And here, and he warns the king. He says, verse 23 is crucial. He points out that that the God who has written on the wall is the one that they were insulting by drinking from the vessels taken from the temple. And I pointed out, did you recall at the beginning of the course, that those vessels are mentioned in chapter 1 and very significant. Okay. Now this is the inscription that was written out. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Now, you notice on your little pictures there, on page 36, I pointed out that we don't know what letter. Now we know, the handwriting on the wall, while it was these words, it did not look like that. That's first place. The large, for those of you who don't know Hebrew, of course it reads from right to left. The larger, darker letters, as opposed to the little dots and commas you see, the larger letters, the Hebrew letters in that day did not have that shape. Letters, as you know, change configuration. Same letters, but just written differently. Did not look exactly like that. Second place, those vowels, those little vowel points, those little dots and commas, those are called vowel points. They were put in, they were not used until the 5th century A.D. To help pronounce, to show non-Jews and those who didn't know how to pronounce it. But, and we don't know that it was written in Hebrew. It had been written in Aramaic and Daniel, but it is Hebrew. That is, Daniel may have translated it into Hebrew. But in any case, the three words now, exceptions noted, it reads mene mene in Hebrew, mene mene tekel upharsin. Now you'll notice in verse 25 of your text, now this is the inscription that was written out, mene mene tekel upharsin. See that? U P H A R S I N. Most of you have that in your English translations. And then you go on down, this mene mene tekel peres. See that? Three words. Mene, mene, tekel, peres. Is that what you have in your English? Well, what happened to upharsin, between upharsin and peres, is this, that the u is simply the Hebrew vav, which means and. Weighed, counted, counted, weighed, and divided. You understand that? So the U, Peres and Farsin is the same word. He just reduced it down. Look at the Hebrew words on the page 36. The one to the far left is the last one. You see that little mark is kind of straight up and down, a little dot beside it? That's a Vav, that's U. And at the end of the word, that's Aramaic. It's an Aramaic masculine plural, in. The root word is pares. Anyway, I'm simply saying that's the same word with the masculine ending and the vav conjunction taken off. Okay. Now the word. Keep in mind, the words are not the message. Now could the astrologers and soothsayers not read the words? I think they probably could. But to know the words, it's not to know the message. It's not a complete sentence. Here are the words. Mene, mene, mene. Numbered. Numbered and finished. Now, as I point the syllabus, why is it repeated? Well, it's repeated for emphasis. This is good Hebrew. To repeat something. Now, what we do in our linguistic style, when we want to emphasize something in the spoken form, we raise our voice, stomp our foot, turn red in the face, and slobber. and you are any one of those things. In written form, sometimes we'll put an exclamation point beside it. In Hebrew, you simply repeated it. In all Semitic languages, repeated it. Mene, mene is emphasis. It means, numbered means, let me give you a modern translation of what this means. It means you have been severely audited. I mean, the auditors, God is the auditor. That's exactly what it means. You have been severely audited. God has gone over your books. Mene, mene. Counted, evaluated, numbered. It means audited. God has gone over your books very carefully. You have had an audit, the lack of which the IRS is incapable of, because he even audits the heart. Now, that's precisely what you have been severely audited. Tekel means weighed. Now, we have this word in the New Testament. You heard of a shekel? Actually, the pronouncement of the Hebrew word is tekel. Comes out shekel in English. And it was a weight of money. So this tekel is the same word as shekel, weight. It means weighed. You have been severely audited, and you've been put in. So the first picture is like an auditor going over the books. God has gone over your books, your accounts, Belshazzar, carefully. And he's put you in the scales to judge you. Been weighed, and you've been found wanting. Look at it, says. This is the interpretation. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. That is, it's closed. He's gone over the books. He's closed up the books. You understand? You've been audited and closed out. You're bankrupt. The books are closed out. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Put on the scales, came up short. Perez, your kingdom has been divided. Now, Perez, by the way, before I go into Perez, I would point out that there has come a cliche from this event into the English language called, I saw the handwriting on the wall, or the handwriting on the wall has become a part of American English idiom, and it comes from this event. Of course, as many of our phrases like that come from the Bible. I see the handwriting on the wall. It means I see it coming. This concept of being of the scales of judgment, it's a very common concept throughout human history, throughout the Bible. Anything sophisticated about that. Perez is the Hebrew word for divide. It's the word Pharisee. Just like tekel is the word shekel. Perez is the word Pharisee. Is the word division. The Pharisees were the divided ones. Those who separated themselves from the Greek culture. By the way, in Galatians, I think it's Galatians 1. I'm going to mention, let me cite it. Galatians, where Paul is talking about himself, he said, Galatians 1, 15. There's a pun here, most likely, but you can't get it in English. It says, but when he who set me apart even from my mother's womb and called me through his grace, set me apart, separated me, Paul was a Pharisee. He separated one. And it's probably a play on words. What he's saying is, I was a Pharisee from my mother's womb. Set apart, divided, split from. And Paul was, I was a Pharisee. Well, I was even a Pharisee from my mother's womb. I was set apart from my mother's womb for this. So it's the word to divide or separate from. And the kingdom is divided. Here's what it means. So it's severely audited, and the books are short, and you're declared bankrupt, and the books are closed. You weighed in the scales, found too light. Don't measure up. Therefore, because this is true, Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. Divided between the Medes and the Persians. Now, that's the meaning. Well, you gotta like Belshazzar. Belshazzar, this is verse 25, verse 29, in my opinion, is one of the most enigmatic verses in the Bible. Yet it is a window into human nature. It says, Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as really a ruler of a third of the kingdom. Now, did Belshazzar believe Daniel or not? He believed the interpretation that Daniel gave him. Well, you'd say,
no.
What would make you say no?
He wouldn't have given Daniel all his presence.
Yeah. If the kingdom's divided, why? What good is it to make him a ruler of a third of it? That's like being the boss over nothing.
If Belshazzar has any humor to him at all, that might have been the purpose of him doing that.
Oh, okay. Well, if I'm worthless, so are you. I mean, if I'm not going to have anything, you can have a third of my nothing.
Yeah.
Like Daniel had come back earlier and said, "Hey, keep it, because it's not going to be any good anyways." He might just be.
So you're saying maybe he didn't believe it, and this is irony. I think that's possible. I don't buy that because it may be right. It may be right. There's no indication of it in the text. But on the other hand, if he did believe it, then what was the use of doing that?
Well, it seemed like he would have been very angry, or he would have been making some last minute preparations.
Why keep his word if he did believe it? You see, if he didn't believe it, or if he did believe it, there was no reason to do what he did, except one.
Pride and moral obsession.
Pardon? He thought that he had time?
Maybe he thought it was fine dancing.
I think that's it.
Oh.
She said, it might buy you some grace. Look, I think he believed Daniel. He obviously accepted the interpretation. And the reason for his kingdom being divided was what? That he had insulted the God. Now, listen to me. Keep in mind, this is a fellow who had been scared spitless. His knees knocked, and he about fell down when the hand wrote on the wall. I think he was thoroughly intimidated, Laurie. And I think he was trying to buy grace. I think he said, "Wow, I'm in trouble." And what did he promise Daniel? He had promised to give him the gold necklace and put a royal robe on him and make him rule of a third of the kingdom. Now, an Oriental despot, they had to keep their word. Remember, we're going to talk later about the laws and the Medes and the Persians that cannot be changed. Once the word was given, it could not be changed, matter of honor. So that may have been involved. But I think let me put it this way. I think Belshazzar did not see himself in a position to give the God of Daniel, or Daniel himself, one more insult. Why was he in trouble? The hand wrote on the wall because at the very time he was drinking out of the vessels of the temple, he had the liver scared out of him, and he knew he was in deep trouble with somebody, with God, and Daniel's interpretation made sense. It may have just been he thought, well, I'm going to keep my word because I cannot break my word, and what have I got to lose? And the one thing I don't want to do is to insult Daniel or Daniel's God one more time. Now, I can't prove that. It's enigmatic. You may be right there. I understand it. It could be any of these. It just seems strange. It's ironic. There's irony and enigma there. You see, why if he did believe, it's a conundrum. You know, a conundrum is. It's an insoluble problem by the way you state it. That is, if he did believe, why do it? And if he didn't believe, why do it? Yes.
I want to ask a question. There's a story of which, kind of off the whole field. The gods of the other gods, did they take some type of form? And why were they believed in as opposed to the God of Israel who had appointed one of those? I just don't understand why their belief was in all the gods. Did Satan perform miracles to these idols?
Pardon?
Did Satan
perhaps in some cases, like the magicians of Egypt. But that wasn't the basic reason. These were just old, this old ingrained Oriental polytheism. It's a part of their culture, part of their life. They've been raised that way for generations. Why do people believe what they believe is a strange thing? Kind of like evolution. Why do people believe in that? Well, it's ingrained. That's the best answer I can give. Not that they were obviously superior to the God of Israel. That's certainly not true. Well, the next thing, did I give a sufficient answer to your question? Now we come to the fall of Babylon, this hour, and the problem of identifying Darius the Mede very quickly. We have this simple statement in verse 30. That same night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain. Now, verse 30. That same night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain. Now, why did not Daniel go into the circumstances? If you didn't know any history, you'd look at that and say, well, you know, what do you mean slain? How? By whom? What happened to him? Was it a court assassination? Did his wife get mad at him? What happened to him? You know, tell me more. We're like the fella those army base they put in the latest computer. We're supposed to have all the information that was ever available put in this one computer. You can ask any question. Staff sergeant pushed the button and said, "Is the end of the world? Is the world going to end soon?" And the machine, and finally it came out. The answer said, "Yes." One word, yes. And he was furious. You know, what kind of answer is that? Yes, you know. So he pushed the buttons. Yes, what? You know, he wouldn't know the rest. You know, the detail. Yes, what? And the machine word came out. Yes, sir. What a great joke. But we read this, we'd say, what? No, tell me more. What do you mean he was slain? By whom? Why didn't Daniel tell us about the fall of Babylon? How it fell. How God carried out this tremendous judgment that he had warned when he wrote on the wall.
Was Daniel maybe not around? Did he make this proclamation? Did he say, I'm out of here?
No.
You want me around when it happened?
Why didn't Daniel tell us?
Shot in the
dark. It's a bad shot, too.
Well,
but nice try. I appreciate it. I had that cup of coffee. Well, come on, you guys. Well, I think it was very pertinent. This great act of God to judge Babylon. Sorry. You all missing the obvious. The question's too simple. The reason he didn't tell it is that everybody knew. The whole ancient world knew.
That's what he said.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear what you said. You said common knowledge. That's not what I thought you were saying. I'm sorry. I'm getting old. My hearing is going. Everybody knew. It was very common knowledge. She didn't have to tell. This is quite exciting. Now, look at me. This is not simply history. I put this in the syllabus because I want us to see the hand of God. One of the things that we ask the question, did Belshazzar believe or not believe? One thing that would have made it hard for Belshazzar to believe is the idea of Babylon falling to the Medes and the Persians, at least soon. Somebody raised the question. Maybe he didn't think, maybe he thought he had some time. I think he thought he had some time. Regardless of how that figured into his decision to reward Daniel. Why? Babylon, mighty Babylon, could not be taken easily. Did I have you read about the city of Babylon on your reading assignments? Did I not? So I won't have to go into that. The idea of Babylon, the idea of Babylon falling before an 8 or 9 to 10 to 12 year siege was ridiculous. To fall within a few days was unthinkable. Herodotus writes in the 5th century B.C. The Babylonians had taken the field and were awaiting his approach, that is, Cyrus the Persian. When he arrived near the city, they attacked him, but were defeated and forced to retire inside their defenses. They already knew of Cyrus' restless ambition and had watched his successive acts of aggression against one nation after another. Remember the bear with the ribs in his mouth? And as they had taken the precaution of accumulating in Babylon, listen to this, and as they had taken the precaution of accumulating in Babylon a stock of provisions sufficient to last many years, they were able to regard the prospect of a siege with indifference. Now, Belshazzar undoubtedly had this in mind. See, they had plenty of water, the river ran right through the city. And so, no problem. The siege dragged on, no progress was made, and Cyrus was beginning to despair of success. And that raises the question, how much of a siege? How long? It wasn't very long, apparently. We'll come to that later. Then somebody suggested, or he himself thought, of the following plan. He stationed part of his force at the point where the Euphrates flows into the city, another contingent at the opposite end where it, should read, flows out, with orders to both to force an entrance along the riverbed as soon as they saw the water shallow enough. Then taking with him all his non-combatant troops, he withdrew to the spot where Nitocris, she was the Babylonian queen who had built the water gates earlier, where Nitocris had excavated the lake and proceeded to repeat the operation which the queen had previously performed by means of cutting. He diverted the river into the lake, which was then a marsh, and in this way it so greatly reduced the depth of water in the actual bed of the river that it became fordable. And the Persian army, which had been left at Babylon for the purpose, entered the river, now only deep enough to reach about the middle of a man's thigh, and making the way along it, got into the town. The Babylonians had learned what Cyrus was doing, or had seen it for themselves in time. They could have let the Persians enter, and then by shutting all the gates which led to the water side and manning the walls on either side of the river, they could have caught them in a trap and wiped them out. They weren't even watching. They were so secure. But as it was, they were taken by surprise, Miss Bell. Taken by surprise. The Babylonians themselves say that owing to the great size of the city, the outskirts were captured without the people in the center knowing anything about it. That's probably likely. But you read about the city of Babylon, how large it was? There was a festival going on, and they continued to dance and enjoy it. Note this. There was a festival going on. What was the festival? Belshazzar's feast, you see. And they continued to dance and enjoy themselves until they learned the news the hard way. This, then, is the story of the first capture of Babylon. Now, let me diagram very quickly for you. We don't have much time. What he's talking about. He says that if they had seen them enter the city, they could have trapped them. Now, you've got the picture there. I got this diagram for you, I think. Yes, should have. Yes, bottom of page 40. I don't need to put it on the board. Turn to 40 very quickly and look at this picture with me. Now look, this is a diagrammatic sketch of Babylon. There was the new, you see the Euphrates River flowing through it? And what they did was, there were gates, water gates, where the Euphrates entered and left the city. First, you got that? Now, we diagram it like this. This is not, of course, the scale or anything. If you diagram it like this, as the river flowed through, what happened was, here the city blocked it off. The Tonkers, the Babylonian queen, had built these gates. What they did then during the low time of the year, when the river was the lowest, this land is very flat. The river flows very slowly, very sluggish. And so what they did was, she dammed it up and diverted it into a big marsh so that the water was lowered sufficiently for them to build the gates in the first place. She left the stones here that she had blocked the river with. So what Cyrus did, and keep in mind that there was a drought, we know, there was a drought, and it was the time of the year when the river was low anyway, so you add the drought, and Cyrus saw his opportunity. All he did was, he stationed men here and here, and said, look, you all wait, and when the river goes down, you're going under the gates. And then he simply took the same stones that the talkers had used and left here, the channel was still cut. He just repeated what she did. Very stupid of the Babylonians to leave it there, because they weren't counting on this drought, probably. So they locked the river, the water flowed into this marsh, it went down, didn't go completely dry, and they went in.
Now he says, but even then the Babylonians could have trapped them. Why? Because there were not only gates here and here, this was the business section of the city, along the river, the business section. There were gates, there was a wall along this side of the river, and a wall along this side of the river, and gates leading down to the river. So that if these gates were closed, then it didn't do you any good to get in to the bed of the Euphrates. You simply face another wall, another water gate, you understand? That is, they were perpendicular to them. When you got into the city, under the water gates, then the streets ran perpendicular to the river, both ways, and these were blocked with water gates, except they were open. You understand that? So what he's saying is, if the Babylonians had been watching, the Persian army could have come in here, and all the Babylonians had to do was to close the gates, and they had them trapped. They just slaughtered them. But they didn't do that.
Why?
They were at a party. Now, you understand that? What he means by that language? So we've seen the logistics of it. Now, we look at Xenophon's account. He offers, top of page 30, he offers essentially the same version. He describes the maneuvers of Cyrus' army. Cyrus waited until a festival was in progress, according to Xenophon. I'm summarizing this paragraph up here, top of page 38. Xenophon states that once the troops entered the city, they went straight to the palace. Once outside the gates, they began to make a great clamor. Xenophon dramatically describes the fight in the palace that occurred when the gates were open, also the fight in the city streets. Very little fighting. But Daniel was probably there when this happened. It happened the same night, the same feast. Because we know these things took place in the palace, you understand? And so Xenophon talks about it. As soon as they got into the city, they turned up these streets and went straight for the palace. He writes, and as soon as the noise and clamor began, they that were within, perceiving the disturbance, and the king commanding them to examine what the matter was, ran out, throwing open the gates. Of all the stupid things to do. First of all, they didn't even watch the main water gates. They didn't bother to close the inner water gates. And as soon as he heard a noise outside, note this, the king had no idea, he had no conception of them being in the city. You understand? They had their provisions laid in. They knew the army was out there. Man, we can hold them off for a year. They'll be getting Social Security before they get in this city. So when he hears this clamor outside the palace, even though Daniel has just warned him, he had no idea it could be in the Persians. So what does he do? Now the palace itself had a wall. The palace itself was a citadel. He could have held out for a long time in the palace. But what did he do? He had the gates thrown open of the palace. Persians waltzed in. They that were with Gadates, as soon as they saw the gates loose, broke in, pressing forward on the runways, dealing their blows among them. They came up to the king. They found him now in a standing position with his sword drawn. It finally dawned on him. That's got to be one of the most surprised men in all of history. They that were with Gadates and Gobryas, being many in number, mastered him. They likewise that were with him were killed, one holding up something before him, another flying, another defending himself with anything he could meet with. You know, table, fighting for their lives. Cyrus and a body of horses, mounted soldiers, cavalry, up and down through the streets, bidding them kill those that they found abroad, ordering some who understood the Syrian language to proclaim it that those who were in the houses to remain within, they were found, they would be killed. But note that here's Belshazzar. He comes out, and all of a sudden he realizes he's in big trouble, draws his sword, and tries to defend himself and those with him as best they can. But what happens? What Daniel said would happen. The king was slain. Now, the Nabonidus Chronicle, that was the Greek account, which is sort of neutral. Now we have the Persian account of it. The Babylonian account. The purpose was to record the events in the 17th year of Nabonidus, the last king. Keep in mind, Belshazzar was his ruler of this place, to trace the rise of Cyrus and to prove that his conquest of Babylon was due to the impiety of Nabonidus. Say, why did Marduk let Babylon fall? Answer is, Nabonidus insulted him and went after the moon god Sin, and Nabonidus was the official king. According to this chronicle, here's how Cyrus entered the city. On the 14th, Sippar was taken without battle. Nabonidus fled. As he came back to defend the city, defend the empire too late. On the 16th, Ugbaru, the governor of Gudium, and the troops of Cyrus entered the Babylon without battle. That doesn't say without any fighting, just without a major battle. They, understand? They didn't batter down the walls and burn the walls, scale the walls. They simply sneaked in and killed whoever they had to, kill, minor skirmishes. Afterwards, Nabonidus, when he returned to Babylon, was taken prisoner. Note this. What it says, Nabonidus, when he returned to Babylon, you got that? Nabonidus was not there. Daniel was right. The critics were wrong. Here's the Persian verse account of Nabonidus. Now, this is the Persian account, now, not the Babylonian. It's a piece of propaganda written as history. And I won't go into that. It says that the king of Babylon was a villain. He interfered with commerce, confiscated lands, allowed the irrigation system to fall into neglect, deserted Babylon. Here's where we learn about why Nabonidus was not there. He ordered the Babylonian New Year festival canceled, the festival of Marduk, until he had completed his project at Haran. He changed the prescribed rituals. He was a heretic. Therefore, Cyrus says, therefore I took the city easily because the people, the gods gave me Babylon because Nabonidus had insulted the gods. You got that? Now, the Cyrus cylinder, this is Cyrus' account. You know what a cylinder was? What they would do is they wanted to send out the record all over the world of what they had done. They make these like, it's like a rolling pin. They would lay down clay tablets and then roll it over it and make many copies, like printing of it. Or they could, understand? And Cyrus cylinder reads this. Marduk, the great lord, compassionate to his people, look with gladness on Cyrus, good deeds and his upright intentions. No, who was Marduk? The god of Babylon. His question is, note this, Cyrus got it all wrong. Daniel said the Persians are going to be given Babylon because of the Most High God. Cyrus gave the credit to Marduk, at least in propaganda. He gave orders that he, that is, Cyrus, that Marduk gave orders that he, Cyrus, go against his city Babylon. He made him take the road to Babylon. He went at his side like a friend and comrade. His vast army, whose number, like the waters of the river, cannot be determined, with their armor held close, moved forward beside him. He got him into his city Babylon without fighting or battle. Who got him in? Marduk got him in. He averted hardship to Babylon. He put an end to the power of Nabonidus the king, who did not show him reverence. The gods of Sumer and Akkad, whom Nabonidus had, to the anger of the lord of the gods brought to Babylon, I, at the bidding of Marduk, the great lord, made to dwell in peace in their habitation with delightful abodes. It's restored. What? Listen, here's what's going on. Let me explain what Cyrus is saying, because of our time. Cyrus offered himself as the liberator. He liberated him. Really? He said, well, everybody was glad to see me, and Marduk got me in. You understand? I'm not an invader. I'm a liberator. I restored the sacrifice and the ceremonies, the priesthood. Was that true? Probably not. You know, Hitler liberated Paris. And Russia liberated Poland and Hungary. And North Vietnam liberated South Vietnam. And Pol Pot liberated the Cambodians. But they always try to picture, he was trying to picture himself as the legitimate ruler of Babylon, not an invader. And here's what he's arguing. I'm the legitimate ruler because look how easy I got in. And here you see a certain irony and a certain truth to what he said. Here's what Cyrus is saying. Look, normally it would take years, 15, 20 years as much even, to a siege of 7 or 8 years was not all that unusual. And a Babylon, greatest city ever built, the ancient world. Cyrus saying, look, I just waltzed in. How'd that happen? I'll tell you why it happened. Because Marduk asked me. Marduk sent me. Marduk got me in. Therefore, it's very clear that I am not an invader. I am the legitimate ruler of Babylon. And the fact that I got in easily proves it. It's exactly what he's saying. You see the irony in that? There's just enough truth in it. Why? Because did a god send Cyrus?
Yes.
Did a god get him in? With little or no fighting?
Yes.
Was Cyrus the legitimate ruler of Babylon? Well, in a way, yes, because did a god choose to give Babylon to Cyrus? Yes. What's the problem?
Wrong god.
But note the irony. Note this, that Cyrus, now let me ask you this, did Cyrus really believe that Marduk got him in? Is this propaganda? Yes. Is it nothing but propaganda?
As far as he was concerned, yes.
Yeah, well, maybe not. Let me point out, I think it's possible Cyrus really believed it. When he came, Herodotus talks about a siege. He had a siege set up, but then he got this idea about the water. Well, and the idea of anything like that working, for instance, you realize the chances of getting in the city were slim, because if the water gates leading down to the river were closed, they'd been in the trap. Point is, Cyrus may very well have said, obviously the gods are in this. Marduk, the chief god of, did he believe in Marduk? Yes. Obviously, Marduk wanted me here because, man, I thought I was going to be here for the next 10 or 15 years. And here I am overnight. Could be, actually believed it, as well as the propaganda, you understand? But my point is that that Cyrus saw, perhaps, very likely, this was a divine act. It's very clear to us, isn't it? The God said, here's what God says to Belshazzar and to Babylon. Look, I've audited this outfit, and they're bankrupt. I've weighed them, and they come up short. I've divided the kingdom, and I'm not going to take all year to do it. I'm not going to take 10 years to do it. I'm going to do it tonight. Which is very significant, isn't it? It was an act of God, a divine act. Yes? Probably did. We're going to see that Daniel was honored in the court of Cyrus as well. In the government of Cyrus' court. I think it's very likely. So did he believe it? Probably not. I don't know. Anyway, he used it. In other words, all I'm saying is we can't be sure that it was nothing. We know it was propaganda. Whether it was pure propaganda is the question I'm saying. I'm saying we can't be sure it was. Because he's a pagan, and he would probably recognize. He never expected to get in that soon. Okay, very quickly, here are difficulties in harmonizing the accounts. These are two difficulties in Babylon, in Daniel. First of all, there is some difficulty in harmonizing the accounts of Herodotus and Xenophon with the cuneiform accounts in terms of the time and sequence of events. That's simply to say there's some confusion. Daniel doesn't deal with that. Understand? So that's a minor problem. That is, exactly which cities were taken, when they set up, there was some confusion. But keep in mind that Herodotus and Xenophon came along a century later. It lost a lot of the details. So we don't know exactly what the sequence of events or the times involved. There is a question of the existence or the length of a siege. Herodotus talks about a siege. Was there a siege? Not a very long one. He had surrounded the city. He had set up a siege. What probably happened, the siege had just got set up, and then he got this idea of sneaking in. But that's not a big problem. I point to the essential harmony on these points of the extra-biblical accounts with Daniel. See what I'm saying here? The essential harmony of the extra-biblical accounts and Daniel, given the fact we have very few details. First of all, Babylon was being pressured by the armies of Cyrus. That's clear. That's in Daniel and in the extra-biblical accounts. Secondly, a festival was taking place. We know what it was. Third, regardless of how much fighting there was, the kind of battle that would have been expected in such a military project did not take place with the fall of Babylon. Now, we're on very solid ground with that. Another minor problem, here the critics have a heyday. They say, now, because the last verse in chapter 5 says this, so Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. Who was Darius the Mede? Mentioned only by Daniel. The cuneiform records do not mention Darius the Mede by that name. Now the critics jump on this and say, aha, it's a mistake in Daniel. They never learn. It's the same outfit that said, who ever heard of Belshazzar? Until the cuneiform records came out, the archaeologists. But the cuneiform records, while they did explain who Belshazzar was, they did not explain who Darius the Mede is. Aha, you say, they say, it's a mistake. Here are the alternatives. The scribes of Babylon and Persia knew nothing of Darius the Mede. In that case, Daniel was probably wrong. Or they knew him, but not by that name. Was it common for these people to go under several names? It certainly was. Very confusing about proper. But it drives archaeologists and ancient historians crazy. Why? First of all, they would be personal names, and then there'd be throne names. And they would change those names. Often as a person changed his station in life, he would change his name. And he would be called one thing at home and one thing by his enemies. For instance, the land of Israel, or Judah, by the Assyrians was called the Hatti land. The land of the Hatti. They never called themselves that. You don't find it in the Bible. And we know from that when foreigners would use other names for them. And it gets a problem when they would sometimes translate the names, and that throws you off. And sometimes they would transliterate them. And when you get into transliterating names, they get very difficult. For instance, Ahasuerus in the book of Esther is Xerxes, transliterated two or three times. It's very difficult, you understand? So between all those factors, names changing, using other names from by outsiders as opposed to insiders, personal versus court names, translations and transliterations, it's not just the Bible. It is exceedingly difficult to identify people in the ancient world. The names that we have of many ancient characters come from the Greek transliteration, which are very far removed from the original. For instance, Achaia in the New Testament is Achaiava in the Greek text. We don't know what it was back home. I could give other examples. So what I'm saying is they knew him but not by that name. That is not a far-fetched solution. That's the very thing we probably expect anyway. Okay, if we take B, which I do, understand? They knew him, but not by that name. Who was he? Here are two solutions, probable solutions. Number one, Darius the Mede is an alternate or official name for a man who is named in the cuneiform records, Gubaru or Gubrius, who was the provincial governor of Babylon. That is, it's very likely that this is there's a book by Whitcomb on Darius the Mede. This is the position he takes. And I think he makes a good case. Can't prove it. It says he received the kingdom, not the whole kingdom of Persia. Cyrus was the king of Persia, but that this Gobrius or Gubaru was made governor of the part of the Persian Empire which was coextensive with the smaller Neo-Babylonian Empire. Understand? The Neo-Babylonian Empire became a section of the Persian Empire, the larger Persian Empire, and this Gobrius or Gubaru was made governor or king of the territory of the Babylonian Empire, which is now incorporated in the Persian Empire. And that he's called Darius the Mede by Daniel, but he's called Gubaru Gobrius. That's probably the answer. Another possible solution is that Daniel 6:28 should be translated. Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius. Look what it says. Daniel 6:28 says, so Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. It could be translated, Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, even the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now, I don't like that. Wiseman takes that view. That is, he's taking the former name as a throne name. That what he's saying is that Darius the Mede was Cyrus the Persian. I think that's not likely. Who was Darius the Mede? Was he Cyrus? I think not. Was he this Gubaru or Gobrius? Most likely. Most likely. And again, that would be not uncommon at all. If you go through the cuneiform records, you would find that would be very, very normal. Okay, and by the way, I'll put it on the bottom of page 41. I've talked about the kings of Babylon, who the king lists, and I put that parenthetical summary just so you have some point of reference. That's the Babylonian kings, and now and below that, we move into the Persian Empire, you'll have a point of reference to check on the identities of the Persian kings. Got done.